the last verse that we're going to be looking at today first. It's in Luke 19:10. It says, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." And this verse is the theme of what we'll be talking about today and the stories that we'll be looking at. And really, this encapsulates the entire mission, ministry, life of Jesus Christ. And this is it. This is the Christian message. I mean, we add all kinds of complicated things and, you know, convolution to it, but this is it. Beginning in verse 31 of Luke 18, which is where we're picking up this morning, it says, "Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, 'We're going up to Jerusalem, and everything that's written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He'll be handed over to the Gentiles. They'll mock him, insult him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. On the third day, he'll rise again.'" He says, "We're going up to Jerusalem." Now, think about what Jesus is saying here. He knows he's going to be tortured and killed at Jerusalem. And where is he going? He's going to Jerusalem, he says. He's fully embracing the mission that God has for him, even knowing the pain and the suffering and the death that's waiting for him there. He says, "Everything that's written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled." It's important for us to see the will and the purpose of God at work in the life and in the death of Jesus. The religious leaders of the Jews will be the ones who have Jesus arrested, put on trial with a bunch of trumped up charges, declare him guilty and worthy of death, and then hand him over to the Roman authorities to be executed, the Gentiles. It will be the Romans who then carry out the torture and the execution of Jesus. But underneath all of this, a promise that God made all the way back in the book of Genesis in the Garden of Eden to the human race is being kept. Through his Christ, God is rescuing a lost world of people. "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." God repeated that same promise many times, many different ways. Prophecies have been foretold throughout the Old Testament of the coming of the Messiah. And now the Messiah has come, and all that is written about him is going to be fulfilled. In Hebrews 1:1, it says, "In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe." It says, "On the third day, he'll rise again." On the surface, the torture and the death of Jesus will look like a huge defeat, a tremendous failure, the shattering of long-held hopes. But in reality, it will be an important victory on behalf of the human race. The curse will be broken. Death will be defeated. Salvation will come to humanity. "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." Verse 34 says, "The disciples did not understand any of this. Its meaning was hidden from them, and they did not know what he was talking about." The idea that the Messiah would suffer and die at the hands of the Gentiles was something that Jesus' disciples simply could not accept as a possibility. It was not something that they could get their head around. They believed, as most Jews did, that the Messiah was coming to rescue them from the tyranny of the Gentiles. To be killed by the Gentiles was totally incompatible with that whole idea. So when the disciples would hear Jesus talk about these kinds of things, they assumed that he was speaking in some kind of figurative or symbolic language. He can't possibly intend us to take these things literally. He obviously has some other meaning in mind. I think it's funny when we think about the fact that the disciples so often mistook what Jesus intended for them to understand symbolically and interpreted that literally. And at the same time, the things that he intended them to take literally, they interpret symbolically. There are things that a person can say to us that are so far removed from what we believe they would or could ever do that we automatically assume they're talking symbolically rather than literally. For example, if I were in this very heated game of Risk or Monopoly with one of you, and if you've ever played Risk with a bunch of guys, you know how heated it can get. There's a lot of trash talk that takes place in a game like that. And one of you might say to me, I'm going to destroy you, Jeff. I'm going to crush you like a bug. Now, I would automatically take your words symbolically, meaning that you are going to beat me in the game. I would never think that you would literally destroy me, that you would literally intend to squash me like a bug. See, and it was kind of like that for the disciples whenever Jesus would talk about being rejected and tortured and killed. The possibility of that was so far removed from reality in their minds that it was simply never taken literally by them until it actually happened. And then they remembered all of the times that Jesus said, this is the way it's going to play out. But until it actually happened, they could not believe it. They said, that's obviously not going to happen. Jesus is going to destroy them, not them destroy him. In verse 35, it begins two stories that we're going to be looking at here. And both of these stories take place in and around the city of Jericho, which is about 17 miles east of Jerusalem. Now, the city of Jericho in the time of Jesus was not the same ancient city of Jericho that we read about in the book of Joshua in the Old Testament, that the Israelites had marched around and blew their trumpets and the walls came tumbling down. That city had been destroyed, but this new city of Jericho had been built, and it's where Herod the Great had built a very beautiful and ornate winter palace for himself. It was an important place of commerce for that area. Much trade went through this city at this time. And this is where these events take place. In verse 35, it begins, it says, as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. And when he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He called out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. So on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus passes through Jericho, and as he's walking along, he's interrupted by this impassioned plea from this blind beggar sitting along the roadside. Now, it was not that unusual to see a blind man sitting along the roadside like this, begging for handouts from those who passed by. This is the way this man made his living, so to speak. There was not an established and organized welfare system like we have today in our own country. A person like this had to rely on handouts from individuals. So they would position themselves in places where people would pass by often, and they would beg. This day, it probably started out like most other days for this man. He got up in the morning and found his way to his usual spot where he liked to sit. But this day is going to turn out to be the most important day of his life. When the man hears this huge crowd coming by and all the commotion associated with it, he asks what's going on. And they tell him that Jesus is passing by. And when he hears that it is Jesus, he starts shouting as loud as he can, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And the people, they try to get him to stop yelling, to shut up, but he just shouts all the more. He'd heard the stories about Jesus himself, just like the others said. He was not going to let this opportunity slip away if he could do anything about it. No matter what other people said to him, he was going to try to get Jesus' attention. So he's just giving it all he's got. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Now, the way that he refers to Jesus is important. He calls him son of David, which is a messianic title. This is the first time in the Gospel of Luke that anyone calls Jesus by this title, other than Luke himself as he's telling the story. See, this man, he may have been blind physically, but he demonstrates more spiritual sight than many around him. He sees Jesus as the Messiah. He believes Jesus to be the Messiah, the Son of David, he says. So in verse 40, Jesus stopped and he ordered the man to be brought to him. And when he came near, Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? Lord, I want to see, he replied. When Jesus hears this man yelling, he asks that he be brought over to him. And then Jesus asks this man what he wants him to do? And he says, Lord, I want to see. See, up to this point, no one has taken this man seriously. He has just been a huge distraction and a nuisance, getting in the way of the real stuff that's happening over on the road where Jesus is. Remember, everyone's saying, hey, shut up, dude. Get out of the way. But Jesus stops the whole procession of people and takes this overlooked, forgotten, despised, outcast person seriously, and he asks him, what do you want me to do for you? Jesus sees this man like no one else does. And this man sees Jesus like few others see him. And now Jesus gives him an opportunity to demonstrate that to this whole crowd of people, the opportunity to express his faith in the power of Jesus, the Son of David, the Messiah, for everyone's benefit. Lord, I want to see. And Jesus said to him, receive your sight. Your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. The city of Jericho is the setting for this next story too, which involves another one of society's outcasts who Jesus takes special attention and interest in. This time, it's not a man at the bottom of the economic food chain. Instead, it's a man who's actually near the top of the economic food chain. In verse 1, it says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector, which means that he was a boss tax collector, a lead tax collector. He oversaw and ran the tax collecting operation in that area. You might recall that tax collectors were despised by the rest of the Jewish people because they were seen as traitors working for the hated Romans, and because they were extortionists, charging taxes far in excess of what even the Romans required, and then pocketing that extra money for themselves, making themselves wealthy at the expense of their own people. Now we have a man before us who is one of the main men of this despised group. Can you imagine how unpopular he must be? In all likelihood, he is public enemy number one in the city of Jericho. People hate Zacchaeus. Word about Jesus coming to town spread quickly. And Zacchaeus, he wants to see Jesus just as badly as everyone else does. See, he'd been the topic of every conversation, everywhere, for months. And now, this Jesus is actually in their city. I mean, what an opportunity. We're told that Zacchaeus is a short man, though, which would make it very difficult for him to catch a glimpse of Jesus with this huge crowd of people around him. So being the resourceful type, he runs ahead along the road that Jesus is traveling on, and he climbs up into a sycamore fig tree so that he's able to see over this huge crowd of people. Now, this photo is of a sycamore fig tree in Jericho, but the photo's not very good, but there's actually two people standing in this tree here. These are very large trees. They grow to be very large, so it'd be very easy for a little guy like Zacchaeus to get up in a tree like that and find a comfortable spot on a limb to watch the goings-on beneath. Zacchaeus is an outcast among his Jewish brothers and sisters. He's betrayed them by working for the enemy. He has become very wealthy by cheating and taking advantage of them. And as a result, he has been shunned in Jewish society. He's been excommunicated from the synagogue. No one who is at all concerned with their reputation associated with him in any way. He's treated like an outsider. And Zacchaeus has probably developed his own resentments toward most of the people in the city too. I mean, it makes it easier that way for him to justify his own behavior, given his profession and the way that he's treating people. And as the way human nature often is, somebody hates me, I hate them back. It's just the way it works. You don't like me? Well, I don't like you either. So you can imagine they don't like Zacchaeus, and he doesn't like them either. And it makes it all the easier for him to rip them off that way. Now, I can't help but wonder what Zacchaeus was thinking about as he is up in that tree watching Jesus come down the road with this huge crowd of people pressing in around him. He may have been asking himself, I wonder if Jesus is like the other religious people that I know. These other religious people, they won't even let me go to synagogue. They've kicked me out. What will Jesus think of me? I'm sure I'm the last person in this city that he would even speak to. I mean, I've lived such a sinful and dishonorable life, I'm too ashamed to even try to get into the crowd and try to work my way up to the front to maybe talk to him. I want to at least see him, though. I want to hear what he says. I want to see, I want to find out, I want to discover if this Jesus is really as wonderful as they've all been saying he is. And as he's having this conversation with himself up in this tree, thinking who knows what, hoping that no one notices him up there, feeling a bit embarrassed and foolish perhaps, feeling unwelcomed, Jesus walks right up to this tree that he's in and looks up at him and he says, "What's for supper? I'm coming to your house." Zacchaeus says, okay. So in verse 5, it says, when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. It's often highlighted in this story how much effort Zacchaeus went through to see Jesus. People try to make this big deal out of, oh, he climbed up in this tree and he subjected himself to such embarrassment because he wants to see Jesus so bad. You know what's more significant? That Jesus purposely seeks him out. Jesus went straight for this guy. Jesus seeks him out. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. He seeks out Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, he had hoped no one would notice him up in that tree. He's trying to be invisible. But Jesus knew he was up there, and Jesus knew his heart, and Jesus goes and finds him. And in verse 7, it says, all the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. Look at how the people react to Jesus going to Zacchaeus' house. They don't think it's an appropriate place for Jesus to go. I mean, this is the house of a sinner. And not just any sinner, but one of the most despised and hated men in the city. Notice, too, that this is not the isolated opinion of a few religious legalists. It's the generally held opinion of the whole crowd. It says, all the people saw this and began to mutter. The word translated mutter means to grumble, to complain, to show disapproval. In other words, the whole crowd of people are having a real issue with what Jesus is doing here, about where he's going and who he's spending his time with. They don't think this is a good idea. They do not like him being with Zacchaeus. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. A deep and profound change takes place in this man's life as a result of his encounter with Jesus Christ. It's always a beautiful and amazing thing, isn't it, to see the change that takes place in a person's life when they encounter Jesus like this. Zacchaeus is making a huge change in his life, and he's not doing it to earn his salvation or to win acceptance from the people. He's doing it as an act of worship and gratitude. He's going way beyond what the Jewish law expects from someone who's making restitution. And why does he do it? Because he loves Jesus, who first loved him. The person who seeks him out and calls him out of that tree and spends time with him, shows him love. This is his response to what Jesus has done for him. Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." Verse 10 is considered by many to be the key verse of the entire book of Luke, because in this one sentence is captured the entire life and mission of Jesus. "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost." And we see him exemplifying that in this story. He purposely seeks out the lost, Zacchaeus, with the intention of saving him. It's still his mission today. It continues to be that today. Jesus is not in the business of propagating religious institutions. Jesus is in the business of seeking and saving lost people. That's what he's all about. During this holiday season, and I refer to it as holiday season, not because we cannot say Christmas, but to include New Year's and all of the other things that are associated with this time of year. But most of us are going to have a number of opportunities to spend with people in settings that we don't normally do. There will be family get-togethers with people that we don't see very often. Maybe there are even people you don't even really like very much. But they're family, and this is the thing you do every year, so, you know, you're there. There will be Christmas parties at work and at school and in the neighborhood. There will be football games to watch together and all of the rest of the things that make this time of year what it is. And I want to encourage you to take advantage of these opportunities to engage with people. Now, evangelism is not something that most of us feel comfortable with. And one of the reasons for that discomfort is the very unnatural behavior that's often associated with it. I mean, it feels contrived and forced and unwelcomed by people because it is often contrived and forced and unwelcomed by people. I want to encourage you to not be driven by an agenda in that way. There are few things that put me off personally quicker than a person who approaches me with an obvious agenda. You're probably that way too. I mean, I can see them coming from a mile off. Don't you think they can see you coming from a mile off? I mean, if I feel like I'm being treated like a project by someone, or a notch in their belt, or a tick on their spiritual scorecard, I mean, there's few things more off-putting than that. I'm not interested in engaging with them. I'm not interested in being personal with them. I'm not interested in sharing or trusting them. We don't want to be like that with people. Develop real, genuine friendships with people. Make that your objective. Listen to people. Genuinely be interested in their life. Let them share their story with you. Their story. I mean, if we have evangelism on the brain, we too often are just looking for that opportunity, that opening to, you know, go for our story, to give our personal testimony of how we came to faith in Jesus Christ. They're beginning to open up, and they take a breath and go, "Well, you know, okay, it's not so effective." That's not listening to the person. It's just looking for our place to take a shot. There's going to be opportunities for you to share your story with that person. But first, just listen. Ask questions. Try to hear. Try to understand the other person. Make that your agenda. When a person feels like you really care about them, you're really listening to them, really trying to understand them, then they are going to begin to trust you enough to listen to your story. I think sometimes we forget that we're to serve. Being a servant means we let everybody else go first, so to speak. It's really important when it comes to sharing our faith with a non-believer. Jesus sets a great example for us in the stories that we looked at today. In the case of this blind man begging on the side of the road, Jesus stops and he gives him attention. A man who the rest of the people just wanted to shut up and stay out of the way. This person just goes, whoa, hold up, stop. That man over there that everybody's stepping on, bring him here. What do you want me to do for you? I want to see, Lord. In the case of this chief tax collector, Jesus purposely seeks him out, a man that others avoid. He's the person that Jesus makes his mission to connect with. May the Lord open our eyes to these people, those that others look past. May he give us hearts like his to seek the lost and the broken and the outcast and the unwelcomed. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost.